as we confront the issues of America's heart and home.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and guests and are not necessarily those of the Information Radio Network, its affiliates, stations, or advertisers.
Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views. Hopefully we're going to have a special guest with us this evening. But until we have him on the line, I want to comment a little about what we see as we read the newspaper. And you don't necessarily want to believe what you see. You want, of course, to listen to what they're emphasizing, what they're trying to get you to believe. And one of the things they're trying to get us to believe is that there's more of a threat from Al-Qaeda now than there was back on the 11th of September 2001. Because, of course, we certainly face more of a threat at any time. We could have terrorist attacks in America. Now, I would like to simply take you back in time. If you've ever studied where Al-Qaeda came from, it was financed by the Central Intelligence Agency. And you go back, and you remember, of course, when it was the 20th of September 2001, when President Bush gave a speech to the American people immediately after the attack. And at that time, he announced that the United States had been the major source of humanitarian aid for Afghanistan. We were the major source of humanitarian aid to Afghanistan. It had been for some time. Well, Afghanistan, of course, was the Taliban, and the Taliban were the people who were hosting Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda. Why would we be funding the people who were giving sanctuary to Osama bin Laden and his Al-Qaeda henchmen? Ask yourself that. Think about what's going on. And then if you study the history of this whole Islamic movement, you'll find out it's been subsidized by the Pakistani intelligence. It has been funded by Saudi Arabia. In fact, about half the people fighting in Iraq today are actually Saudis, half the Al-Qaeda that are there, and they're not that many, maybe at the most a couple of thousand, and half of them came from Saudi Arabia and were funding Saudi Arabia. Why would we be funding the people who are funding the Al-Qaeda who are killing our boys in Iraq? Why would we be funding the Pakistani military that is funding the Pakistani intelligence, that's funding the Taliban that are killing our boys in Afghanistan? Or is this simply Vietnam all over again, where we funded the Russians, who funded the North Vietnamese, who funded the South Vietnamese, who were killing our boys, the Viet Cong? Well, let's go to our special guest this evening on an entirely different subject, and that is Brad Dacus. Brad is a lawyer who, of course, has foregone the profits of a private law practice to form something called the Pacific Justice Foundation, and to carry in the courts this battle against Christianity, because a part of the battle going on today, in addition to wanting to create a new world order, the enemies of freedom want to create a new world religion, and they're frankly hostile to Christianity. Well, Brad offers hope to people who come under attack because of their religious beliefs, to organizations, to individuals. And we're going to let him tell you about what the Pacific Foundation is doing. They're doing a great service. We certainly support what they do. We'll be back in just a moment with Brad Dacus. Well, Brad, how are you doing tonight?
Oh, doing just great.
Why don't you tell us a little bit? Tell our listeners who don't know much about the Pacific Justice Foundation a little bit about your organization, how it works, and what it accomplishes.
Oh, you bet. Well, we at Pacific Justice Institute work really hard to defend faith, family, and freedom, religious freedom for all, and particularly those who are oppressed the most in America, which are Christians. And we also go to bat for the rights of parents over their children, and how they teach their children, train their children, and of course we have a lot of conflict sometimes with public schools who decide that parents have no rights and try to push ideologies and things on little children that violate the beliefs of traditional parents with traditional values. And then we also go to bat, you know, of course, for churches who are told they can't build or grow or expand. We defend them without charge. People in the workplace who are oppressed because of their faith or their traditional values that they may have and hold dear to to them. And we also provide emergency counsel to parents who are threatened by social workers who want to take their children unjustifiably. And so these are all areas we do to protect faith and family in the United States today.
Well, do you think that the attack on Christianity is growing in intensity, or is it subsiding?
Well, it clearly is. As the cultural divide grows wider and wider between those of faith and those without faith, without question, it's become more blunt and more obvious in all these different arenas that we're engaging in.
And certainly there really seems to be increasing almost prejudice against Christianity, much more so than ever before. Would that be a fair statement?
Oh, very fair statement. And particularly in places like California, where the culture war has become so much more intensified than perhaps other parts of the country. But it is a national problem and a national trend that has definitely created these conflicts throughout the country.
All right, fine. Well, because Brad Dacus is on the front of this truly epic struggle between Christianity and between those people who would destroy Christianity. And there really are people in our country today who hate the Christian faith upon which our freedom is based. And, of course, had it not been for the beliefs of our founding fathers in Christianity, America would not be a free nation today. We'll be right back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Brad Dacus, and Brad is sitting on the front lines of this battle against Christianity today. There really is growing hostility towards Christianity. The FBI has told you can tell how to identify a terrorist. They're the people who, of course, believe in the second coming of Jesus Christ, that these may be the end times. I know I had a call from an FBI officer down in Oklahoma at one time, wanted to know about my religious faith. You say it couldn't happen. Go up on our webpage and pull down the, we have a copy of the pamphlet that was circulated by the Phoenix Anti-Terrorist Task Force under the auspices of the FBI back, about the year 2000. And they said that you knew how to really identify a terrorist. The people who talked about the Constitution, people in the Christian identity movement, people who believed in the end time scenarios. And that's how you can tell if people are terrorists. And you have to understand that this is what they're teaching members of the Federal Police Force, the Federal Bureau of Investigation. That's how you identify terrorists. They believe in the Bible and the inerrancy of the Scriptures. And increasingly, we see this divide that Brad Dacus talks about. Well, tell us about some of your cases, that some of the things that are going on today that the average Christian is not going to be aware of unless he's on this legal battlefield.
Well, one of our most dramatic cases we've undertaken is the defense of the phrase, "In God We Trust," which is our national motto, which is put on our currency, our coins, our dollar bills. This has been challenged by Michael Newdow, and he's challenged it to alleging it to be unconstitutional, and so we've violated the First Amendment's Establishment Clause, and so he filed this lawsuit to challenge it, to have it removed, and we, the Pacific Justice Institute, didn't want to stand around and hope that the U.S. Department of Justice is going to argue this correctly, because in the past, these kinds of cases, like the Pledge of Allegiance, they'd say things like, well, if the phrase really doesn't mean anything, it has no meaning, so it's okay. It's just like a phrase like "God bless you" when you sneeze, and we just think that's a bad way to argue these cases.
Maybe that's what they believe, though. I mean, I think there are some people in this current administration who profess to be Christians, but they don't really believe in the Christian traditions of this nation.
Well, yeah, and I think it's important that people understand that the phrase "In God We Trust" specifically has tremendous meaning, and it's a statement of our history and our heritage as a nation. You know, we justified on the Declaration of Independence, our whole premise for justifying our independence was premised upon the existence of the laws of nature and nature's God. But for that, we would be an illegitimate nation, according to our Declaration of Independence. And then even the constitutional rights that we have, those are all premised, the fundamental rights are premised upon the Creator, which have endowed us with these rights. So it's a very true statement, and to allow it to be removed from our currency is just a further allowing of society and to wipe away our history and allow someone else to rebuild it from something that it wasn't. And that's definitely away from God and away from any kind of final accountability for which a democratic republic like ours is dependent upon. And in fact, our founding fathers recognize that if people don't believe that there's anything above themselves, then inevitably we'll lose our freedoms and our liberties because people will abuse those freedoms.
Well, now, how then have you become involved in this case against Michael Newdow? Are you arguing as a friend of the court, amicus curiae, or are you actually going right into the court procedures themselves?
Well, we filed a motion to intervene. We're actually in the court. We filed a motion to intervene, and the judge, we do some creative arguing, the judge granted it. And so we are the only organization in the country that's actually in court arguing this case. And in fact, Dr. Stanley, we filed a motion to dismiss, and the federal judge agreed with us, dismissed the case, kicked it out of federal district court. Our attorneys did just a great job. However, Michael Newdow, of course, doesn't take things lightly, and he's filed an appeal to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, and we're going to be arguing that now before the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals when it comes up.
Well, now, is the Justice Department involved at all?
Yeah, the Justice Department is involved, but we're not relying on them to make the kind of arguments that really need to be made for the future of religious freedom, because theirs have been, in the past, their arguments have been very watered down and diluted from having any real significance for precedent purposes.
Well, why would that be? Certainly we're told that the current administration is a Christian administration, that our president is getting, you know, praise to God, and God is directing this. Why wouldn't he direct the Attorney General, the Justice Department, to argue these issues dealing with God and religious faith effectively? Why would he let them get away with saying the term "In God We Trust" is of no consequence?
Yeah, that's a good question. In a way, I just like to think that the president is not aware that this is too much of a micro issue, perhaps, and he's relying too much on his attorney general, who may not share those same, you know, beliefs as that I hope the president would have. But I just know the reality is what it is, and that we really can't count on the U.S. Department of Justice to make the kind of arguments that really need to be made to defend the people of this country when it comes to these kinds of cases.
Well, I'm certainly glad that you and the Pacific Justice Foundation are there. When will this come up to be argued before the Ninth Court?
We're not sure yet. A date hasn't been set yet. The Ninth Circuit is not the quickest when it comes to case matters like this, so we don't know. But I can guarantee you, we'll definitely be putting it out on our webpage and in our press releases when we do have that information. And in fact, if people would like to receive our press release and keep up with our cases, I encourage them to go to our webpage, pacificjustice.org. That's simply pacificjustice.org, and there they can sign up to get our press releases and our case updates. They'll find them very, very enlightening.
And I'm sure you will. Well, what are some of the other cases, then, that you have, on the docket?
Well, one case we've had, and actually it's finished, but it just wasn't settled not very long ago. It was defending the rights of prison ministries to be able to send Bibles to inmates. Now, in California, in some prisons say, well, you can send Harry Potter and other books, you know, Da Vinci Code, whatever, but you can't send the Bible because it's a religious book. And so we filed a lawsuit, Dr. Stanley, on this because we think it's very, very important that prisoners be able to receive the Bible directly by, you know, from prison ministries, just like they can any other kind of book. And for obvious both legal reasons as well as spiritual reasons. Well, anyway, we filed this lawsuit in federal court on behalf of the prison ministry. The federal judge granted our motion for summary judgment, agreed with us. And then the U.S. Department of Justice, it looked like they weren't going to change their policies for their other prisons, but just one. And so our attorneys at the Pacific Justice Institute made it very clear that, hey, you either, you know, state of California, you either change these policies for all your prisons, allow all prisoners to receive Bibles, or we're going to sue every single one of them, one by one at a time. And they changed their policy, and we're real pleased about that. Every prison now in California allows Bibles to be sent to inmates.
Well, certainly, do they allow the imams to go in? Do they allow Muslim clerics to go in and preach the Muslim gospels?
Oh, yes, they do. And in fact, actually, that's been somewhat problematic to some degree because some of the Muslims who go into prison, the clerics, have with them a message of hatred. Now, I'm not saying all of them, but I know that some of them have a message of hatred, of divisiveness, of, you know, favoring the very radical philosophies of some of the terrorist-type-minded leaders in the Islamic world. So that's been a real concern because the last thing we want is our prisoners to convert to that kind of a religion with that kind of a violent philosophy that some of the clerics are pushing.
Well, my understanding is that in some prisons they actually have their special times for their prayer 5 times a day. They have special food. They have all sorts of special considerations and special Muslim holy days. Would that hold in our state prisons?
Yeah, it probably would. And the real issue that we've dealt with, of course, is it's not been accommodating the fact that they're accommodating for the Muslim inmates. It's been the issue has instead been not accommodating for Christian inmates or people who are interested in the Christianity or feel a need to address that part of their life that they've been ignoring. And that's why this our victory was so important in this case. And of course we are also of course concerned though about those clerics, Muslim clerics who are in the prisons, who are pushing a violent philosophy and a very extremist Muslim kind of a philosophy. That of course be very dangerous and damaging to our country when these people are released someday.
Well, you know, my thought would be that if you really wanted to curse to change people, our prisoners, to get them to the point where they're not going to go out and commit more crimes, it would bring them into a personal relationship to Jesus Christ. And if they really believe the Christian religion, they would not be becoming criminals. It's almost as if by discouraging opportunity of our prisoners to get Bibles and to hear the word of the Lord, they're actually encouraging more violence. Here in America today, we have over 7 million Americans in prison, probation, and parole. It looks to me like we're doing something wrong in our prisons. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I agree 100%. Yeah, I really do. We are doing something wrong in our prisons. And
maybe we ought to be, certainly not quite so hostile towards Christianity, at least on the part of of some people. Whose idea was it to take away the Bibles?
It was a different prison warden that had addressed that issue and decided to do that. Like I said, they've been trumped by the courts, and they won't be able to do that any longer. They'll have to allow the Bibles to be given to inmates.
All right, hold up. We'll be back in just a moment with Brad Dacus, Pacific Justice Institute, on the front lines of the battle for the survival of Christian civilization. Well, Brad, what are some of the other issues that are before us at the present time? Because Christianity is constantly under attack. There are people who would do everything.
Gold and silver is tremendously undervalued. Global demand vastly exceeds mine supply by more than 60% annually. There is little in the financial world more certain than a coming explosion in the prices of gold and silver. The U.S. dollar continues to lose value and respect as the world's reserve currency. Our nation faces challenges on many fronts, and a day doesn't pass without another economist bringing forth warnings of impending economic calamity. There has never been a better time than right now to acquire physical gold and silver. Discount Gold and Silver Trading was founded on the principles of truth and honesty. We believe in providing a quality product, quality service, and most importantly, competitive pricing. We provide all forms of precious metals, including American gold, silver, platinum, and rare investment and circulated coins. Silver bars, rounds, and 90% silver bags are on hand for the silver investor. Gold self-directed IRAs are available. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. Toll free, that's 1-800-375-4188.
Most Americans are iodine deficient today because they stopped adding iodine to our milk and to our flour, and only about half of the salt that's consumed in the United States today contains iodine. So Radio Liberty has produced a four tape or a four CD set that discusses the health benefits of iodine. We also offer iodorol. It contains 12.5 milligrams of iodine per tablet. And we also offer potassium iodide tablets that'll protect your thyroid gland in case there's a nuclear attack. So if you'd like to order these products or obtain additional information, why don't you call 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927, or go to our website at RadioLiberty.com. That's RadioLiberty.com. Once again, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927.
You got headaches? Most headaches are caused by a structural weakness of blood vessels in the head, and the blood vessels are tending to balloon, causing a headache. The structural weakness is due to a deficiency. Correct the deficiency and the body will heal itself. I blended what I believed to be the missing nutrients in the right proportions, and the headaches went away. When they were gone, they stayed gone. I named it Headache Stay Gone. See HeadacheStayGone.com or call 800-327-0727 for more information or to place an order. I'll send you a bottle of Headache Stay Gone. Headache Stay Gone will cure your headaches and prevent them from coming back before you pay the bill. Headache Stay Gone has already cured the worst migraines I have ever heard of. Call 800-327-0727. All orders are shipped the same day. Call 800-327-0727. That's 800-327-0727.
Hi, this is Dr. Tony Teary. Are you one of the many people who take vitamin supplements? Do you take handfuls of pills each day to increase energy, reduce your pain, or improve your overall health? Now there is a better way to get the vitamins and minerals your body needs in a delicious tasting whole food liquid supplement, Body Balance. Body Balance contains 121 essential vitamins and minerals and is made from only organic and natural sources. Developed by doctors, Body Balance was originally available only through healthcare professionals. Now this incredible whole food liquid supplement can be delivered directly to your home. Body Balance offers an extremely effective method to feed your body towards wellness, and we're confident you'll love the difference your body feels. To order your Body Balance, call me directly at 1-800-768-9763 and try it risk-free for 45 days. Again, that's 1-800-768-9763 or online at healthyfoundations.net.
people of, you know, read the Quran to them. But has refused the same thing for both Jewish and Christian students. And, of course, Brad needs to take the case to court. But at least so far they don't have any parents. Well, are the parents down there upset about this? Or are they just so placid that they wouldn't stand up for much of anything?
Oh, many of the parents are very, as we understand, upset about it. But we have to have some of those parents willing to be a plaintiff in an action, because otherwise we won't have standing to challenge the school district. So it's real important that if there's any parents down there that would like to challenge the school district in this regard, that they contact the Pacific Justice Institute. Perhaps, you know, some of your listeners may not have kids in the school district, but they have grandkids. Well, you know, probably need to contact their children and see if their children would like to have their be plaintiffs in that kind of a case.
Well, don't you think a lot of people are afraid to do that for fear that the school district will discriminate against their children, that people would rather just sort of switch than fight? Isn't it a lot easier to go along and get along than to take a stand, and then you become a target for the anger of the school administration? And after all, if you don't get good grades, why, they can make your life miserable.
Well, that's a real fear that many parents could have, and I can see that. However, first off, in a case like that, we could seek that they have anonymous protection so that their name is not exposed to the school district, but to the judge. That's something that we can possibly arrange. And also, school districts also have learned the lesson that if they ever harass parents, in fact, we want a number of parents, not just one or two, but they ever harass parents because of an action like this, that it can really have a major backlash on the school district even more. So generally speaking, in a case we've taken on challenging school districts, the parents and their kids actually are treated very well and respected, because they know if there's any backlash, the school district could face even greater legal ramifications and lawsuits down the road.
All right, fine. Well, this certainly sounds like an exciting lawsuit, a very well-justified lawsuit. It's a shame that we have to have these things taken into court. They should be so logical, except that there really is an intense hatred of Christianity and everything Christianity stands for, and I really believe that this is really behind so much of what's going on today. Would you agree or disagree with that?
Yeah, I really would, and that's why I encourage people to go to our webpage at pacificjustice.org, pacificjustice.org, where they can keep up with these cases that are coming down and can really understand what's going on, and can get our receive our press releases without charge. We send those out to the media. The one that the individuals get out there, the press release, the ones that they get at the same time that the news networks and news reporters out there get it. It's real-time press releases.
Right, and of course, Brad is doing a great job, and he is trying to utilize the press and media as much as you can, and on occasion you'll actually see Brad on statewide television and even national television discussing some of these issues. Well, what else do we have coming down the line?
Well, there's so much. One matter I'd like to mention is dealing with the city of San Leandro. This is a little different setting. This is a different kind of an issue. It involves churches and their rights to be able to build, grow, and expand, and be freed from local governments who want to keep them from doing so unreasonably. Well, we have many cases like this. In fact, about 40% of our cases are defending churches who want to build or expand, and then told by local governments they're not allowed. And San Leandro is one of the latest that we've undertaken like this. Here's what happened. A church, it's a four-square church, a wonderful church, love the Lord, you know, serve the community. This four-square church decided to buy a building, and that's a great thing to do, because then you don't have to start from scratch, and you don't have to have an environmental impact report. There's a lot of advantages to going that route. Well, they bought this building, and they're going to start having their church services, and the building's, you know, it's a safe building, and it meets all the, you know, requirements for the community. It's already built. Well, the city said no. The city of San Leandro says no. We don't want a church there. We're not going to let you have it, your building. And in fact, the reason they gave Dr. Stanley is pretty surprising. The reason was we want tax revenue, and we know if we allow a church to be there, we can't charge them property tax because churches are exempt from property tax as a nonprofit institution serving the community. So since we want property tax, we don't want to let that church be there. So, church, you can't occupy the building that you bought, that you paid for, and that you need to use.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back here. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here. I guess it's Brad Day, because we're talking about the city of San Leandro. And, of course, they've objected to a church utilizing a building that they had bought and paid for, because the community wanted, of course, to get the property taxes from the building. And, of course, the church would be exempt from taxation. So under the guise of, certainly, we want money, we want tax revenue, we're going to say you can't use the building. Well, isn't there a federal law that prohibits that sort of foolishness?
Well, yeah, there is. It's called the Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act of 2000. It's a very powerful federal statute. And basically it recognizes that churches have a right to build absent a really compelling issue like health or safety raised by the local government. Now, frankly, Dr. Stanley, we shouldn't even have to have this kind of a federal statute. The Constitution, to be interpreted correctly, would already grant this kind of protection under the Free Exercise Clause of the Constitution and the First Amendment. But the Supreme Court has watered that down, so federal government passed this RLUIPA statute. And so when it comes to situations like this where we have local government saying, well, we don't want a church to be there or a synagogue to be there because we want more tax revenue. Well, that's not a health or safety issue. There's no that's not a compelling reason. And it's an illegitimate reason for them to raise that to try to keep out a church. And this church, mind you, is paying a hefty sum. I think it's about $11,000 a month just to make their payments on this building, because property is not cheap in the Bay Area, wherever you are. Including the city of San Leandro, and yet they can't occupy the building. And that's outrageous that a church should be in that kind of a situation. And the city knows it. I think they were just trying to strangle the church, so they forced the church fiscally to just have to give up the building and go away. And that's why we at the Pacific Justice League stepped in and says, no, we're going to represent this church like we always do, without charge. And we're going to go to bat for them without charge, and that's just what we're doing. And we have a huge attorney network of over 500 volunteer affiliate attorneys just in California alone, roughly over 1,000 nationwide, that make this possible.
All right, fine. Is there any way, Chris, you could make a claim against the city for barring their ability to use the church, and it would be expensive for the city, having kept them from being able to utilize the church and gain income from it?
Yeah, it is possible.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back.
Sure.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Brad is talking about a case in San Leandro where the local community says to this church that has actually bought a large, expensive building, you can't occupy this building. Now, the church is having to put out $11,000 a month payments on the building. And yet, of course, the city says you can't occupy the building, you can't utilize the building, because we want to get more in the way of course revenue. We want to be able to tax it. We can't tax it if you are actually, you use it as a church. Therefore, we are going to block you. And so they're playing these games. And so the church, I'm sure, probably is having, quite a bit of a problem financially, isn't it? Having $11,000 a month payment and no income from the building?
That's right. That's absolutely correct. And that's why it's so important we move very quickly and firmly, because otherwise, they're going to be up a creek even worse, in a much worse situation in the weeks ahead if we didn't. So.
All right, fine. Because Brad, they have 500 attorneys here in California. They have 1,000 throughout the country. Attorneys who work for nothing. I know we make lots of jokes about attorneys, but there are some good attorneys out there who love the Lord, who see the injustices going on, and are willing to give of their time and substance to help Brad and people who are really being persecuted because of their faith. And they certainly deserve our admiration. They certainly deserve our prayers. And the Pacific Justice Foundation needs our prayers and support as well. And with that said, would you like to get out your website? Would you like to get out your telephone number so people would know how to get in touch with you if they need help, how to get the regular material you put out, and how to get your email notifications?
You bet. Our webpage is really interesting. They can look at our information there, our opinion polls and things like that. And that's at simply pacificjustice.org, pacificjustice, one word, pacificjustice.org. And I encourage people to go there, to pacificjustice.org, where they can sign up to get our press releases, our case updates, and really keep abreast of what's taking place as it happens. And so we encourage people to do that. And then also we have a toll-free number where if people would like to, if they need help or assistance, or if they'd like to become a part of our team. You know, we're a nonprofit. We're totally supported by individuals who believe in what we're doing. They can go to our webpage and become a part of that team to support us, or they can just call us up and support us also, and we can add them to our list of people getting our information. And that toll-free number is 888-305-9129. I'll repeat it again. It's 888-305-9129, and there they can 305-9129, and there they can contact us if they need assistance, need help. Also, I do a lot of guest preaching at churches, by quite a bit, and I'm going to be actually speaking at church in the East Bay area of San Francisco in a couple Sundays, or Sunday after this next Sunday. But I do a lot of that, so if anyone's interested in me coming to speak to their group, their organization, or their church, I'd love to do that. I do that, of course, without charge as well.
Well, we've had Brad come down several times to our seminar, and incidentally, our seminar this year is going to be on the 28th of October, and if you haven't marked that on your calendar, I hope you will, but we've had Brad in the past to come down and always been an excellent speaker. I could recommend him to you. Well, Brad, let's get to some of the other issues. And if you're out there across America listening, you have a question for Brad, don't be embarrassed. You can call us at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295 here in the Central Coast of California. Well, what are some of the other issues you're dealing with?
Well, I guess over the next 20 minutes, we've got, I could be talking all day about our cases and all the things we're handling, but the next case that I'd like to mention, though, is up in the state of Washington. And the state of Washington deals with the defense of the institution of marriage. The city of Seattle has decided that they wanted to ignore the voters who said that marriage is between a man and a woman, and that's how it should be defined. And they said, oh, no, we're going to give marriage benefits to same-sex couples. Well, that's not what the law says. And their attitude was, well, we don't care. We're progressive. We can do what we want to do because it's liberal. That means if it's liberal, you're basically going to ignore the law. I mean, I'm exaggerating, obviously, but that's really the philosophy we see played out sometimes. They think since they're politically correct, they can ignore what the law is and the will of the voters and the taxpayers. So they decided, Seattle decided, we're going to give benefits to homosexual couples and to further this agenda, even though the voters said differently. So we went ahead and filed a lawsuit challenging that before the court there. And we did not prevail on the lower court level. It was a liberal judge who decided and said, oh, no, this is, you know, they can do this and they can ignore this referendum by the people of the state of Washington. And then so we appealed to the appellate court in the state of Washington. And that was just argued by Matt McReynolds, one of our attorneys on staff, actually, blew up, argued that case before the appellate court. And we'll have to see how it turns out. If it turns out favorably, great. If not, then we'll take it on appeal to the state Supreme Court.
All right, fine. But of course, does the state law then supersede the decisions of the city council?
Yeah, it should, because it's very specific and as to what is marriage, and therefore, you know, if it's, they can't redefine marriage. You know, the local governments can't. You can't have marriage defined one way in one town in Washington and defined another way in another town in Washington. That's chaotic, and yet that's exactly what the city of Seattle says they can do.
And basically, of course, what this is, certainly if homosexuals are going to live together, they have a right to do that. They can assign their death benefits or other benefits to their partner if they want to. They're really very, very little other than calling it marriage. And don't you really think that this is simply an issue to keep the pot boiling all the time, to keep us distracted? I mean, what does it matter what you call it? I mean, why do they want to call it marriage? It's not a marriage. A marriage is between a man and a woman for having children, and this is not the purpose of their joining together. So why do they want to call it marriage? Or do they really hope this will be an affront to the Christians, an affront to God?
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, if their goal and intent was saying, well, two people care about each other, and you know they're living together, they care about each other, and we just want to help them be able to care for each other. Well, if that's the case, then why don't they allow, I say, a granddaughter living and taking care of their grandmother to have those same benefits? The reason, of course, we know is because they're not engaging in certain acts of objectionable sexual conduct. So really what cities do when they have these kind of policies is they're not saying we're just going to look out for people who are going to care for each other. They say, no, we're going to look after people who specifically are engaging in certain these kind of unconventional sexual conduct, and we're going to do it at taxpayers' expense. And there's no compelling reason to justify that kind of a distinction. It's very hypocritical, to say the least.
All right, fine. Well, at least you're on the front lines, and at least the average person up there in the state of Washington who has gone to the trouble to vote and you get the legislation through, and then the other people say, well, we're not going to abide by the legislation. We don't care what the majority says. We don't care what the law is. We're going to do what we want to anyway. And I think that somebody has to hold people responsible. All right, fine. Well, Brad, now, are there any other important issues that you can think of? And once again, I mean, I put our telephone number out. It's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. So I know that there are so many issues that you're dealing with all the time. What about, you know, the social workers who want to take the children away from families? They seem to think that, you know, if the family wants to homeschool or doesn't want to get vaccinations, or it's almost as if the children belong to the state and not to the families any longer.
Right, absolutely. And parents need to realize that they do not, for example, have to allow their children to be vaccinated. That's a myth. They're told they have to in order to in school. Parents actually have the right to object to that. We represent parents on that. There's a number of controversies that are coming out about different vaccinations and the way it's done and how it's done and which vaccinations the kids are receiving that may be objectionable to parents who read different reports. And so we go to bat for parents who want to protect their children. And in addition to that, though, we also deal with social workers, though, who sometimes will investigate or interrogate children at school. They'll see a bruise on a child and talk to the child, say, do your parents ever hit you? And the child will say, well, yes. And the child's really saying, well, I get spanked. And the social worker, you know, looks at that as being hit and then tries to take the child. Well, we give emergency counsel to parents whenever they're approached by social workers, want to be questioned by social workers about them possibly being abusive of their children. And obviously, there are abusive parents out there, and they need to be, approached at, and the children need to be protected. But we see so many times, Dr. Stanley, where social workers take children from wonderful families simply because the families occasionally spank their child or homeschool their child or something that may be unconventional that is still very sound. And so we go to bat for those parents and in terms of providing an emergency counsel to keep the children from being taken. And then we're also drafted model legislation for all 50 states in the country to be able to adopt that would give the kind of proper due process protections to protect both the child and the parents from such an unreasonable intrusion by a social worker.
I really think that the average person doesn't understand that certainly that we have two classes of justice in the United States. One is, of course, the family courts, where you really have almost no standing, and where if you get into one of those courts, you're going to lose. I mean, I've heard this story over and over again. And, of course, then there's the regular courts where you have a trial by jury, things of that sort. But in these family courts where the judge can simply arbitrarily take the children away, and there really is no appeal, is there?
You're right. It's all behind closed doors. Unlike a regular criminal case, when it's in family law court and they're dealing with possible abuse or neglect by social workers being alleging against parents, that's in family court. In those situations, it's behind closed doors. There's no jury. Unlike a regular criminal case, we have a jury of your peers. You don't get a jury of your peers. And it's all behind closed doors. And it is, and there's, they allow evidence in, for example, otherwise wouldn't be allowed in. For example, they'll let the social worker just say, well, this is what the child told me, all these things. And you can say, well, where's the recording? Oh, we didn't record it. Where's the audio tape? Oh, or videotape. No, there's no audio videotape. And that wouldn't be admissible in a federal court. They say, no, you've had to audio videotape it. In California, in particular, in many other states, that kind of evidence is allowed, and it's just whatever the social worker says, and everyone nods their head, and off goes the child and given to, you know, a homosexual couple, two men or two women, or some other lifestyle, whatever, that is totally different to what the parents wanted for their child and what the parents believe, and it's repulsive.
Well, many times aren't these children really psychologically and sometimes even physically molested in this environment that they're placed by these family courts?
Oh, they often are molested and abused.
But then what comeback does the parent have against this rape of their child's soul and sometimes physical rape?
Well, legally speaking, there's very little that parents have. Nonetheless, if that ever does happen, when that does happen, we encourage people to contact the Pacific Justice Institute. We do have civil attorneys or affiliate attorneys who would be interested in investigating those kind of matters and possibly filing an action against the agency. But that said, they are very difficult cases to win because the deck is stacked so heavily in favor of social workers.
And so you're trying to actually get those laws, which are totally unjust and, in my estimation, so totally one-sided, and really, of course, they've done so much harm to our children. You're trying to get at least a level playing field or get those laws modified to protect the children?
Oh, absolutely. And we've seen a number of states look at it and legislators try to offer it as legislation. Even in California, it's been offered as legislation, the reform that we recommended. But the reality is in California, with the liberals in control of the legislature in California, the state assembly, the state senate, it's just not able to make it through to the governor's desk. The Democrats are keeping it. They do not want parents to have and children to have greater due process protection. And yet, we're talking about a criminal case, they've been very kind in the past to giving criminals more due process protection, things like that. But not when it comes to parents, the fundamental issue of never seeing their children ever again. I think that is repulsive. And I hope that people put pressure on all their state legislators, Republican and Democrat, to come around and do what's responsible, to do what other states have already done, like Oklahoma and other states, to amend their system to give proper protection of children.
And I don't think the average citizen, the average person out there listening to this program, really understands what a terrible system this is. And when you lose your children forever, with no justification at all, and you're not allowed to do anything to defend yourself when the courts are really stacked against you. And you go into that court, let's face it, you have no rights. So what sort of counseling do you give to parents who are going to come under this sort of an attack from the social welfare workers?
Well, the first thing we advise them to do is not to allow the social worker into their house, and instead ask the social worker to come back, say, the next day, because they're busy, they're going to leave, whatever reason you want to give, but just don't allow the social worker. Don't be mean, don't be, you know, rude, but just, you know, firmly say, hey, you know what, I'll be happy to talk to you, you know, if you can come back tomorrow about 9 o'clock, whatever, in the a.m., in the morning, or 10 a.m., I said, right now I'm really busy and I've got to get out, I've got to leave, da-da-da. So, and then the social worker will probably take that and say, okay, and they'll plan on coming back tomorrow morning. The key is for the parents at that point to immediately pack up their bags, their luggage, and what they need, and when they're sure the social worker is not there and there's not a police officer down there, pack up their car and quickly leave the premises and go to a place where they're not going to be discovered very easily. It could be just a hotel. It could be friends of families or their relatives. And then have the children examined by a child, a pediatrician, and a child psychiatrist recommended by their clergy, by their pastor or their priest. That is, you know, not linked with the community clinic or something like that, where there's a high risk that they could...
Hold that thought for just a moment here. Go right ahead, Brad.
So... Anyway, have the children examined by a child psychiatrist that's not linked to a community clinic, but one that's private and recommended by a clergy, because usually they're more likely to be level-headed and reasonable if they are recommended by, you know, a pastor or a priest or something like that. And then second is, and have that report issued, you know, that where there's no finding of abuse or neglect on the child, you know, by the parents. And then also have the child examined by a pediatrician, where the doctor, you know, examines the children, issues a letter, a report saying there's no sign of abuse or neglect on the child, and then have those sent certified mail to the social worker and the supervisor with a cover letter saying something along the lines of, you know, I know you're very busy. We had to leave town, but nonetheless, I wanted to enable you to close your case on the matter so you can. I know you have many, real cases of abuse, you know, that you need to deal with. So please find a close to attached letter, both from the psychiatrist, both from the doctor. If you have any questions, feel free to contact the doctor or psychiatrist. And then have a CC at the bottom, Pacific Justice Institute. So it's also clear to them that you know what you're doing and that there are attorneys like ours, us, that will step in. And what you've basically done is by providing this kind of opinions from a psychiatrist and a pediatrician, is you usually almost always dispel any reasonable suspicion of abuse or neglect. And if they don't have a reasonable suspicion of abuse or neglect, they have no justification to continue to investigate the family, to question the children, to take the children for several days and interrogate them. And that's the key, is to cut that off right there, and that's how you do it.
Well, I know, but what happens if you have a very aggressive person who's really out to get you, because some of these people really seem to have a chip on their shoulder.
Well, if the parents have done what we recommend and have solid letters from the psychiatrist and the pediatrician, and the social worker is still pursuing, in those situations, those are ones where we need to be contacted. If the social worker continues to pursue, and then we will send a very strong legal demand letter to that agency, ordering them to back off or face a civil lawsuit.
And I think that's so important, Brad, because I know you know how common this is. The average listener out there doesn't understand that once this process gets started, it can lead, you know, to that child being taken away forever for no justification, and that child's life will be destroyed, the family will be destroyed. I've seen grown men weep telling this story of this horrible feeling of hopelessness. I'm so glad you're there. God bless you. Thanks for everything, Brad.
Well, thank you, Dr. Stanley.
Well, this is our Dr. Stan. I guess it's been Brad Dacus, and thank you again for being with us tonight.
Well, it's my pleasure, Dr. Stan.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Let me tell you, though, that if you do have a problem along this line, get in touch with Brad, and don't let it get out of hand, because once it gets out of hand, you can lose your children forever. Because there are people who believe that the children belong to the state. They have an entirely different worldview. And, of course, they hate Christians, and they hate the family, and they want to get those children, who many times they will give them to homosexual couples, but they'll be abused sexually, and there's nothing you can do about it. So it's a nightmare situation. Understand, we're involved in a spiritual battle, and our children many times are the battlefield where that's being fought. If you really want to, of course, get more information on what they're doing to our children, you need to get Dr. Abe's video, Mercury Autism and the Global Population Agenda. That's Mercury Autism and the Global Population Agenda. You need to get some of our 4 tape sets on autism. 1 of every 6 children in America has some sort of a neurodevelopmental abnormality. You don't find this in other countries where they don't have their vaccines. And, of course, our incidence of juvenile diabetes and juvenile allergies and juvenile asthma and juvenile mental problems is rising really at a frightening level. They know what they're doing. They just don't want you to know. You hear all this talk about, oh, my goodness, all the pathological obesity, even a recent article coming out saying why we think that diet drinks are bad for people. Oh, my goodness, you know, people should be having diet drinks. It makes them fatter. And, of course, it makes them fatter because they have aspartame in them, and they know it produces pathological obesity. How could you cover that up? They control the media. And there's just a few places like Radio Liberty where you're going to hear the truth. You need to get our 4 tape sets on aspartame. You need to get the DVDs on Sweet Misery and Sweet Remedy. And certainly you need to go to Betty Martini's website and pull her material down at doorway.com, DORWAY.com. You need to get my talk on Nundare Cholecystocyte. Nundare Cholecystocyte. You need to understand how not only the fluoride in the water is being used to lower the intelligence of our children and to poison them and make them impotent and certainly to actually limit population growth. That's the talk, hidden agenda, the syllabus that goes with it, the 4 tape sets, the DVDs on mercury, the DVDs on fluoride. They're all available from Radio Liberty. Go to our website at RadioLiberty.com, RadioLiberty.com, and simply ask yourself, with all the money we spend on education, why is it that on the average when our students, American students, graduate from high school, they can't compete with children from other nations? The Amish children can. The Mennonite children can. Homeschool children who certainly are not, you know, certainly taking the vaccines and being poisoned with the fluoride and the aspartame and the other things, they can compete. What, anybody really want to damage the mind of a child? Let me once again suggest the DVD or VHS, Mercury Autism and the Global Population Agenda Program. And when you get that, of course, you'll get a CD-ROM with thousands of pages of documentation on the toxicity of mercury, and they know about it. But since they control the media, you're never going to hear about it. And then if you want to know what they're doing to our troops, you need to get the DVD Beyond Treason, and you get a CD-ROM with that that has thousands of pages of government documents showing that they know they're poisoning our boys, and they're sending them over there not only to die in battle, but to die from depleted uranium poisoning. That's Beyond Treason by Joyce Riley. Pray for America. Pray for revival. Please pray for Radio Liberty. Our number again, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-5-HIB-WAR, because America is under attack today. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I did remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests, and, well, certainly for this next hour, we're going to have with us Mr. William Grigg, who formerly was one of the chief editors of the New American magazine, is now working, certainly has his own website, own information, and certainly one of our favorite guests. We're so glad to be able to have him with us here, and we're going to be talking this evening about some of the new presidential directives and the frightening implications as far as the limitations on our freedom. And I think it's so important that people understand there really are people out there in America who want a dictatorship. Now, if you doubt that, let me suggest the book, The Plot to Seize the White House, was written many years ago about a Major General Smedley Butler, the most highly decorated Marine general we had in the 1930s, who was actually asked to lead an effort to seize the White House and create a fascist state. 20 or 30 years later, it would be what, in the 1970s, that would be almost 40 years later, while William Still's father was with the military, and he was approached under the Nixon administration to see if the military would go along with the dictatorship, where, of course, Richard Nixon would be the dictator, and this is when Nixon faced impeachment. That story is told in William Still's book, The New World Order, which we carry. And, of course, there are people today who want to centralize all power in Washington, D.C., in violation of our Constitution. The secret to our freedom is that the power of the government is to be limited. There's to be checks and balances, but there are very few things that the federal government can do legally. Unfortunately, most of our legislators have sworn an oath to uphold the Constitution and protect it from all enemies, foreign and domestic, and they themselves have become the treasonous enemies of freedom, actually passing laws and voting for laws that are frankly unconstitutional. In fact, most of the people back in Washington, D.C. never consider the Constitution they've sworn to uphold when they're voting on legislation. But what's even more frightening are some of the new presidential directives and executive orders. With that as a background, William Grigg, thank you so very much for being with us.
Dr. Stan, it's great to be with you again.
Well, why don't you pick up the story and we'll go from there.
I think that most people who are observant today, who are paying attention to what's coming out of the Bush White House, are properly concerned over the fact that we're dealing with an administration here that literally considers itself above the law. Just last Friday, I believe it was, Mr. Bush notified Congress by way of the organ of the federal government that calls itself the Justice Department that the Justice Department's not going to enforce any of the subpoenas that Congress would issue to try to investigate misbehavior by executive office officials. And that's, of course, an impeachable offense in and of itself, because one of the few things the president's supposed to do is to take care that the laws are faithfully executed. And now we have the president saying by way of the Justice Department that he considers himself and his minions literally to be immune to any kind of prosecution or any kind of congressional accountability. So we're living in an era right now of what we have to consider to be executive despotism, whether or not it's fully reached its flowering is a matter of some dispute, but we certainly know what direction we're going.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back in just a moment with William Grigg. And I think everybody should be very concerned. Well, why don't you go right ahead?
Yeah, the thing that I find remarkable about what happened last Friday is that it is a matter of statutory law for very good reason, as well as constitutional principle, that if somebody is subpoenaed by the Congress to offer testimony in the course of an investigation by the Congress of the executive branch, the person who is summoned to Congress has to testify. Now, that person does not have to incriminate himself. The person can take the Fifth Amendment, which is something that every citizen in the United States can do. There is no way that Congress or any other investigative body or any other judicial body of this government can force somebody to offer testimony against himself. So, if, for instance, Harriet Myers, the former counsel for the White House, who was subpoenaed by the Senate, wanted to, she could show up and say that by virtue of her immunities protected by the Fifth Amendment, she declines to answer the questions that are put before her. That's her right as an American citizen. What she does not have the right to do is to defy a subpoena, and it is certainly not the place of the president to encourage one of his former associates or one of his current subordinates to defy a subpoena. But Bush has done that. Bush has ordered Harriet Myers and a number of other officials not to respond to congressional subpoenas. Now, that is a felony under Title 18 of the Federal Criminal Code. And on Friday, the Bush administration went so far as to inform Congress that they would not permit any of the U.S. attorneys in the Justice Department to prosecute a contempt of Congress charge that would be made against somebody like Harriet Myers. So you not only have a cover-up here and the subordination of a criminal offense in the form of Bush telling Harriet Myers not to respond to the subpoena, you now have the president instructing the Justice Department to defy their responsibilities under the Constitution, under applicable statutes, and under their oath of office to carry out a prosecution of a criminal offense. And so really you have here a fully functioning criminal syndicate rather than a presidential administration. That's one dimension that we're dealing with here, is just the petty, arrogant corruption of the Bush administration. But what turns it into a regime, as opposed to a mere criminal syndicate, is the claim that the Bush administration has made repeatedly that the president is a law unto himself, that he has the power through signing statements to set aside any portion of a law that he signs after it has been presented to him by Congress. Any part of the law that is properly enacted, the president can set aside and the interest of what he would perceive to be national security or national interest. And you also have, just last week, what I consider to be really the capstone of this entire architecture of institutional criminality, an executive order signed on July 17th entitled Blocking Property of Certain Persons Who Threaten Stabilization Efforts in Iraq. I will just paraphrase what it says because it's written in a way.
Hold that thought for just a moment here. We'll be right back here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest is William Craig, and he's pointing out that this last week, why the president issued a directive having to do with seizing the property of anybody who is blocking their efforts in Iraq. And, of course, why don't you go ahead and pick up the story, because this is done without congressional authorization. It's done under a presidential edict. But, of course, what is he really threatening to do?
Well, once again, the name of that directive is Blocking Property of Certain Persons Who Threaten Stabilization Efforts in Iraq, and it asserts a power on the part of the president to seize control of the property and other financial assets belonging to, and I quote now from the directive, any person determined by the Secretary of the Treasury in consultation with the Secretary of State and the Secretary of Defense to have committed or to pose a significant risk of committing an act or acts of violence that have the purpose and effect of threatening the peace or stability of Iraq or the government of Iraq, or undermining efforts to promote economic reconstruction and political reform in Iraq, or to have materially assisted such an act or acts of violence. On the face of it, that directive would apply to people who are supporting various guerrilla elements in Iraq, whether you're talking about the indigenous Sunni resistance to the U.S. occupation, or whether you're talking about Shiite elements who are fighting the Sunnis and who sometimes find themselves fighting American soldiers in Iraq, or whether you're talking about opportunistic terrorist groups that have attached themselves to the movement to expel the United States and Great Britain and whatever allies we still have from that country. And that would include predominantly people from Saudi Arabia. We're being told that Iran and Syria are promoting the effort to expel the United States from Iraq, but actually more than half of the people who are doing the actual fighting are from Saudi Arabia, which is a country that is very close historically to the Bush family in terms of financial and diplomatic affairs. But the point here is that if you are materially aiding those people, obviously this directive would apply to you. But that directive would also apply to people who, in a peaceful and legal fashion, set out to express and act upon their opposition to the war and occupation in Iraq, or who are trying to expose the corruption of those who were involved in what is called the reconstruction of Iraq, which would, of course, be Halliburton, KBR, any one of a number of several dozen or scores of contractors, Blackwater, DynCorp, you probably know the variety. But if you're somebody who is exposing what's going on in terms of the corruption of the so-called reconstruction, or if you're trying to bring about U.S. withdrawal from Iraq, or you oppose some element of the Bush administration's agenda, you would fall under the aegis of this executive decree, which means that on the strength of a determination made by three cabinet secretaries, none of whom is a member of the judicial branch, none of whom would be considered to be a member of a jury of your peers, you could have your assets frozen, your bank accounts confiscated, your property taken from you, particularly if you work in concert with other people, if you're part of an organized effort to bring about an end to the occupation of Iraq or to expose the criminal of Halliburton or something of that sort. You could find yourself expropriated under the terms of this executive order, which is not a law. I mean, Dr. Stan, you pointed out that an executive order is not a legislative act, and thus it cannot be treated as a law for the purpose of prosecution. Ironically enough, that's a principle that was validated in the early years of a republic, back in the first term of George Washington's presidency, when Great Britain and France were at war. There were a lot of people who wanted to intervene on the part of France, because France had come to our aid in the war for American independence. George Washington very soundly wanted to keep out of that war, because we wanted to say a course of neutrality. And so he issued a proclamation called the Neutrality Order. There was a man whose name eludes my memory right now, who decided of his own volition that he was going to build and supply to the French a number of ships. And he was arrested and thrown in jail, and he was prosecuted under the terms of George Washington's proclamation. And the individual in question appealed his conviction to the Supreme Court, which held against George Washington. They said that George Washington had exceeded his authority as president by issuing executive order and having it enforced as if it were a law enacted by Congress. And George Washington, to his immense credit, said, "I got it wrong." He didn't say that in so many words, but that was the essence of what he said by way of reacting to the Supreme Court's decision. "I will, of course, defer to the Supreme Court. They're correct. That was not within my constitutional authority." So he requested that Congress enact the law asserting American neutrality and the American citizens from getting involved in the war between the United States, or between Great Britain and France. And Congress promptly did. It passed a law that was signed by George Washington that was more or less the same as the Neutrality Proclamation. And now you have George W. Bush doing pretty much exactly the opposite. Instead of asserting a neutrality, what he's saying is that if you, as an American citizen, oppose this undeclared, unconstitutional, illegal, ungodly, immoral war in Iraq, then you are violating what he is pleased to consider a law, which requires that American citizens support the agenda of the Bush administration in Iraq. And if they organize to oppose it, they do so now under the terms of this executive order on threat of having their livelihoods, their property, and their wealth seized from them. And one thing that I want to make very clear here is that expropriation of political dissidents is the step, the next to last step. It is the penultimate step before mass incarceration of dissidents. That's the direction we go. You were expropriated, then you were incarcerated, then if necessary, you were liquidated. But we are pretty much the next to last step before we'd literally start seeing people being rounded up. If this is enforced, if people actually have their assets seized and their property confiscated under the terms of this executive order, the very next step is mass incarceration of dissidents. Mark my words, write it down, it will happen.
Well, I think that we should all be very, very concerned when we realize, of course, that Halliburton is getting some $385 million a year to stand by, ready to build concentration camps, that they are actually refurbishing the Japanese concentration camps from the end of the used during the Second World War for $38 million, that there are literally dozens of old army camps and that have had the wire on them, you know, certainly reversed, not to keep people out, but to keep people in. There are concentration camps all across America. Certainly they're empty at the present time, or with only a few prisoners in them. But why are they doing this? Unless, of course, they plan on civil unrest, unless they plan on people objecting to the plans of the administration, and they're planning on rounding up Americans, and I think most recently, certainly the John Warner Defense Appropriation Act, that did away with posse comitatus, and posse comitatus was a civil war, post-civil war legislation that said you cannot use federal troops against American citizens. And certainly the Congress and Senate, to their disgrace and shame, have passed legislation reversing posse comitatus, and at this point in history have deem that the government should be able to use the U.S. military, which is trained for only one thing, and that is to kill and destroy, to use that against the American citizens. I think this is indeed a frightening issue, and certainly forebodes poorly for the survival of our freedom.
You know, you bring up the issue of Halliburton building detention centers. This is done for the putative purpose of dealing with the problem of illegal immigration. But the problem here, of course, is that if you take a look at the history of Halliburton building facilities of this sort, you have a rather ominous precedent in what happened in Cuba, because in the late 1990s, under the Clinton administration, Halliburton was given a contract to build a large facility at Guantanamo Bay, supposedly to house Haitians who would be surging from that island in the direction of Miami. And unlike Cubans, Haitians are not permitted to come here and touch the ground and be regarded as refugees, so they had to have a place to keep the Haitians, supposedly, and that's why they built Camp X-Ray at Guantanamo Bay, which is now used, of course, as an interrogation center. And so you have the same company who built that interrogation center, who are building a number of special purpose facilities, much larger, but pretty much the same as we see at Guantanamo Bay, on the soil of the United States, supposedly for the purpose of illegal immigration and controlling the same. I remember a few weeks ago, Michael Savage, on his radio show, the Monday that the amnesty bill died in the Senate, saying something I've not yet been able to confirm, but he was very insistent about it. He said that during his regular evening walks in the Bay Area, he will come across the Department of Homeland Security office there in San Francisco. And he describes how there are row after row of buses, which are black with blacked out windows, in the parking lot of this major depot of the Homeland Security Department. He says, these are for the illegal immigrants. We're going to be loading these up and sending people across the border back into Mexico. And I heard that and I chuckled. Actually, I laughed out loud rather derisively, saying, no, that's not what the buses are for. They're not going to be loading up illegal immigrants and sending them south of the border. They're going to be using these for other purposes, just as they will use these special purpose detention centers for other purposes, apart from detaining illegal immigrants, because the plans call for the border to be abolished in 2010 anyway, if the Security and Prosperity Partnership is consummated and we end up with a relationship between the United States, Canada, and Mexico that is akin to the one that we see between, say, Oregon, California, and Nevada, where borders are largely trivial and you can move across them at will. What they're doing is they're setting up the infrastructure of something much more ominous, which would be basically, once again, dealing with severe internal dissent that would be the result of, I believe, severe political turmoil occasioned by an increasingly bellicose foreign policy and the concomitant terrorist attacks on our home country, and also, I suspect, with the accelerating economic turmoil that we're going to experience. You might notice that the dollar has hit bottom and started to dig. I don't think that that's incidental to the discussion we're having right now.
No, I don't think so either. I think we're heading into severe economic problems. I think that they're planning on increasing unrest. In fact, there's going to be a meeting up in Canada here in September where they're going to discuss the massive epidemic, either bird flu or other epidemics we're going to have to deal with. What do they know? What are they planning? Certainly, if you've read Zygmunt Brzezinski's book, Between Two Ages, he talks about the ability to create terrible new diseases that will inflict large numbers of people. That's what they call the enemy. Well, William, why don't you go right ahead?
When we're talking about the economic situation, I think it's interesting. I believe we spoke about this last week, Stan. The fact that the Secretary of Housing was in Beijing just a week or so ago to beg the Chinese to start buying more mortgage securities because the subprime mortgage sector is in free fall or in meltdown. You pick your metaphor. And that basically, the mortgage refinancing and real estate element of the economy has been what's kept the consumer economy afloat as people have been drawing equity out of their homes to consolidate debts and to extend their lines of credit. And lines of credit, to use a hoary but applicable phrase, lines of credit are ropes of bondage. You know, the Bible teaches us that the borrower is always the slave to the lender. And so when we're borrowing money to the tune of hundreds of billions of dollars from the Chinese, and we're asking the Chinese to come in and start buying up the bad mortgages, buy up the paper on the housing sector, what we're doing right now is we're setting up a situation where Beijing's basically going to be our landlord. And over the last 2 or 3 years, we've seen how a number of otherwise quite obscure investment firms, such as Macquarie out of Australia and a couple of other enigmatic interests, have been buying up U.S. infrastructure, toll roads, water systems, highways. Macquarie bought up a bunch of newspapers in the Southwest so that they could shut down opposition to the Trans-Texas Corridor and the North American Highway. But you see, the foreign interests are buying up our infrastructure, and China is now being asked to buy up our housing market. If you equate our situation nationally with that of somebody who gets into severe problem managing the finances of the household, here's where we stand. Our homeowner, having defaulted on his mortgage and pretty much all of his other consumer debt, has lost his home. His car has been repossessed. He's pawned all of his appliances. He's emptied out his bank account. So what's left to sell? Well, he's looking at his children right now and trying to figure out how much he can get for taking them down to the blood donation center and selling their blood and plasma. I think what we're going to see over the next several years would be what I call, in an essay I published today on my blog, a blood for debt swap. You've heard of debt for nature swaps, where a country that has defaulted on its World Bank loans or forgive me, its loans to the International Monetary Fund will be asked to put up its natural resources as collateral for a renegotiation of its debt. I think we're dealing with the same thing right now. We're talking about a blood for debt swap, where in order to keep our foreign policy afloat and to maintain the pretense that the empire, we have to keep borrowing money, and the collateral on which these loans will be based will be the conscription of our young as a great resource, the great natural resource, the last natural resource we have to put in hock would be our children to be coffin stuffers for imperial wars abroad or to be drones to carry out menial service on behalf of the welfare state here at home. We have an aging baby boomer population that will have to be taken into hospice care. We have infrastructure that will be in the hands of entities that will have to be maintained. So where are we going to turn in order to fill the positions that these tasks will generate? Well, go to the eighth plank of the Communist Manifesto, and it talks about the universal liability of all to serve and the creation of great industrial armies. And that's what we're talking about now. I believe that sometime in the next couple of years, there's going to be the reimposition of some kind of conscription, most likely disguised as a
Hold that thought right there, program. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and William has been talking about the sorry financial state of our nation. Certainly, so much of the infrastructure of our society is being sold off. Certainly, our major highways, many times our bridges, New Jersey Turnpike's being sold off, the Chicago Skyway, the Ohio Turnpike, the Trans-Texas Corridor Highway is going to be built by foreigners. The Chinese communists are being asked to buy up our housing bonds. The shaky mortgages are out there. And William is suggesting that we're very soon going to have an involuntary draft where our children can be simply forced into servitude to serve the wishes of society. I mean, what's wrong with serving? There's nothing if you want to do it voluntarily. But you really want the draft to be instituted so that the government can force your children and your grandchildren to serve the purposes of society. Pick up the story there, buddy.
Yeah. What people need to understand here is that conscription is, you could call it 100% taxation. The principle of conscription dictates to us, and this is something that the New York Times said in a July 1863 editorial applauding the Union's imposition of a draft during the war between the states. What conscription says is that the government has the right to every right arm and every last dollar in its own defense. So conscription means that the government can conscript everything, can take everything from you, including, you know, your very blood in your veins, the very breath in your lungs, in order to protect itself. And so it completely inverts the stated purpose, the stated relationship, rather, between the state and society. The state supposedly exists to protect us from the anarchic violence of predatory, lawless people. If you read Romans chapter 13 of the Bible, the only reason God permits governments to exist, I believe, is to wield the sword of justice against the evildoer, to protect the innocent. That's the only excuse for this exercise and coercion that we call government. What conscription does is says, no, you exist to protect the state, and so it will seize everything that you have and everything that you are and use it as your rulers see fit. Anne Williamson, an expatriate writer who was with the Wall Street Journal for about 10 or 15 years, she speaks fluent Russian. She covered the breakdown of post-Soviet Russia into its current state of organized gangsterism about a year ago, a little more than a year ago, was talking about how it's her belief that in order to maintain the current imperial profile that Washington has assumed, it's going to be necessary for Washington to make some kind of a great deal involving an international tax, that people are going to have to be pooling their money internationally in order to support the multinational organizations, UN, NATO, and so forth, that are going to be taking over a great deal of this project of collective security. That means that our troops abroad will eventually be serving overtly under UN command or through some UN affiliate like NATO. But what that also means, according to Anne Williamson, who's been talking with people who are involved in planning these things, that you're going to have some kind of collateral being put up in order to make this deal palatable to our international investors, those who hold the paper on America's debt. And the collateral, of course, that we would put up would be the full-scale socialization through conscription of America's young people. And the American population we're talking about would be basically ages 18 to 45 or older. And Christopher Dodd, who's one of the leftmost leaning candidates in the Democrat presidential field, that's saying something as well when you got a field that includes people like Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. Christopher Dodd has made national service the centerpiece of his campaign. And several other people on the Democrat side and on the Republican side as well have talked about the idea of national service. John McCain, whose presidential bid is faltering, has made that a touchstone of his campaign as well, the idea that we all owe service to the state. There are others who have said pretty similar things. Rudy Giuliani has said similar things, and Mitt Romney has made casual comments endorsing the idea of national service. George W. Bush has as well. One of the really asinine things about this discussion is the idea that only if you have some kind of a certificate from the state endorsing your service, it counts as service. That's the only circumstance in which you get credit for your services of actually doing it according to the state's dictates. Anybody who provides any kind of service to anybody else, for pay or otherwise, is serving our society. You don't have to have the state broker that transaction in order to get credit for it. But unfortunately, from the statist point of view, coercion is the magic ingredient that makes state-ratified action morally superior to voluntary cooperation. And so that's where we're headed, I believe, in order to prevent the absolute financial collapse of our country. Some kind of a grand bargain is going to be made where we will become a fully functioning collectivist society with conscription as a salient feature of our public life in order to work out some kind of a compromise, some kind of a continuing arrangement with our foreign creditors who are going to be owning most of our infrastructure and our housing sector as well.
Hold that thought. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and William is suggesting that we're going to have some sort of a conscription where our people can be forced to work for other national entities because we have a massive debt that can never be repaid. And we, all our dollars are out there all throughout the world, and of course there's not enough dollars here or value within all of our stock market and all of our property to pay back all the money that we borrowed from other countries. We have been able to escape the ravages of inflation by simply exporting inflation to other countries. But those dollars are out there, they certainly would, well, we will have to do one of two things. We will either have to enslave our people to pay back what we borrowed, or we will have to simply say, we're not going to redeem our currency. Sorry. All you people out there throughout the world who are holding dollars, you're just out of luck. We're going to renounce our debt. And of course, this is another very real possibility. Put on exchange controls. Nothing goes in. Nothing goes out. But whichever alternative we seek, why, there's going to be great loss certainly of value for everybody, for whether it be our people or people throughout the world who left holding dollars and told, sayonara, too bad, you never should have believed us.
Yeah. Well, we could get both at the same time, which is something that I think is a possibility. Look, it's not as if we're going to run out of dollars, because that would mean we'd run out of zeros, and nobody's going to run out of zeros. If you take a look at what happened in Brazil in the 1960s, 1970s, and 1980s, when they were undergoing hyperinflation, you can go back and take a look at the actual physical banknotes and see where they had zeros stamped after the officially printed figure on the face of the various denominations of currency. I can't remember I think it's the real, but don't hold me to that. The Brazilian currency was undergoing freefall because of hyperinflation. They couldn't print the notes fast enough for them to retain whatever value was assigned to them, and so they would be crudely stamped with three or four zeros after the face value of the currency. If you took a look at the Reichmark that came out in the 1920s during the hyperinflation of Weimar Germany, often they were printed with only one side, because by the time they fell from the printing press, they had lost multiples of their face value because of the hyperinflation that went on for a number of months. And, of course, the iconic image of that period is people taking wheelbarrows full of paper currency to the grocery store in order to buy a bushel of potatoes or a loaf of bread. So that's an option that is available to us. That's the sort of thing, of course, that conjures up incredible nightmares.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back here. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is William Grigg. And, of course, William is talking about fact that we could, of course, face inflation. Massive inflation in the United States in an effort to pay off our debts. That's one way of getting rid of debts. You simply inflate them away. Of course, we see this going on in Rhodesia today.
Oh, yeah.
A nation that we actually brought a Marxist, a thug named Mugabe to power over the objection of the people, and the only reason they accepted him is because they had Henry Kissinger's promise that if things ever started to get out of hand there, America would come to their aid. Henry Kissinger gave his word as a man of integrity, and let me tell you, Henry Kissinger's word and $15 will buy a cup of coffee anywhere in the world today. But anyway, of course, today in Rhodesia, the official inflation rate is about 4,000% a year. Over 300% a month, and of course rising. Go right ahead.
Yeah, I'd say that Henry Kissinger's word has exactly as much innate value as a fiat currency dollar.
Right.
None. The thing about what I see happening with our huge debt overhang here is that if we chose debt repudiation, either by simply telling our foreign creditors that they shouldn't expect to be repaid, or repaying them in increasingly depreciating dollars, I think the result would be pretty much the same, because monetization of debt is nothing more or less than slow-motion repudiation of the debt. What you're doing is you're simply saying you're going to keep subdividing the value of the money that you use to pay off the debt until it's basically worthless. What happened just a couple of days ago is that the dollar pitched radically downward against the euro, which is an amazing thing to me, that the dollar will be losing value against the euro, which is also a fiat currency, which is issued, as I've said before, by a largely hypothetical political entity with no history. Take a look at the euro notes. This is a point that I have made. This is one that Ann Williamson shared with me. If you take a look at the dollar, or the euro, the actual note, usually it's decorated, or disfigured would be a better word, with pictures of people who've never lived in buildings that have never been built, because the euro has no history, unlike the dollar. And the dollar is losing value, comparative value, against the euro. And one reason that happened was because in a number of countries who have large foreign exchange holdings of dollars, they reached targets in terms of the money supply that dictated mandatory sell-offs of a portion of their foreign exchange holdings. When that sort of thing starts to happen, then people are sending a signal that they no longer want our fiat currency. They want something tangible, which is why you have these people coming into the United States and buying up infrastructure, you know, buying up land, buying up existing roads and other tangible assets that have value. And that's why I believe if China ends up buying into the mortgage sector, they'll end up starting to seize commercial and residential real estate, because that's stuff that has value, unlike the gaudily decorated pieces of rag paper that we call dollars, or the digital equivalent thereof. And so you end up with a situation where if we want to hyperinflate our way out of our debts, that, of course, would destroy what remains of our middle class. If, on the other hand, we're looking for collateral, about the only thing we have left, really, would be the physical lives of young Americans who would be sold into the modern equivalent of indentured servitude because of our indebtedness as a country. The situation that we've been put into by our rulers, both in the political system and in the Federal Reserve System. And that's what I see happening. And a lot of this, as Ron Paul has pointed out repeatedly and urgently, a lot of this is a direct result of our foreign policy. You cannot run an imperial foreign policy and expect not to go into debt, radically into debt, and you cannot expect to remain free, which is why we're reaching a point now where, unless we repudiate the imperial foreign policy of Washington and bring our troops home from the, what is it, 138 countries where they are stationed, and realign our defense, or realign rather our military to be an actual defense arm of a very modest Republican government, pretty soon we're going to be facing some pretty ugly consequences that have about them the distinct odor of Weimar Germany just before the advent of Nazism.
Well, because what my belief is that our leaders really do not want a solution. I believe that they want to impoverish our people, and so they will be willing to go into their one world government, which is the real objective of our leaders. They want a one world government, they want a one world religion, they want a one world ruler, and the only way to do this is to destroy the financial infrastructure of this nation, to impoverish our people. And under those circumstances, the people will look to government, of course, for the solution. And one only has to look back a few years when Alan Greenspan was opposing efforts to regulate the hedge funds, and people in Washington, D.C. were saying, don't you understand if those hedge funds ever start to fall apart, they're heavily leveraged, why, it's going to create all sorts of economic problems. People want to regulate the derivative market. And Alan Greenspan and the Fed consistently opposed efforts to do what was logical. They were encouraging mortgage brokers to give these unsound loans. That they were encouraging people who could not afford to buy a house to buy a house on the with an ARM, certainly the adjustable rate mortgages. Mm-hmm. And it's those adjustable rate mortgages that are going bad in the subprime market that are threatening now to basically destroy the hedge fund market, and of course that'll bring down the derivatives.
Mm-hmm.
They have intentionally done everything they could to set our financial system up for destruction.
Well, if I'm not mistaken, what the housing secretary, Alphonse Jackson, was trying to sell in Beijing about a week and a half ago would have been derivatives from the mortgage market. That is to say, the securitized bonds that were issued through some kind of alchemy that defies the understanding of any rational person, where you transmute these bad debts into assets that are traded as bonds, securities. And what they're doing right now is they've gotten to the point where the unwinding of these derivatives and these hedge funds seems to be all but inevitable. The very last ditch that they could, where they could take up a stand against the inevitable unwinding of these instruments, will be to go back to Beijing, which has been funding our public debt, and ask them to start funding or start taking up the derivatives of the housing and mortgage sector. And I think that one of the things that we're going to be seeing very soon is in these inner cities, and it's not just the inner cities. We're not just talking when we talk about these horrible subprime loans, or what in some markets were called ninja mortgages, no income, no job or asset mortgages that were issued. We're not just seeing that in the inner cities where black people or other people belonging to ethnic minorities were induced or enticed, seduced into taking out these loans. We've seen that a lot with people even out here in Idaho who are agricultural workers up here from Mexico, whether legally or illegally, where you have foreign language, in this case Spanish language, mortgage brokers who excel in getting these people who really are very tenuously connected to the United States and to our communities to get them into the mortgage and the housing market, you know, get them to buy a home on mortgages that really 5 or 6 years ago couldn't have been issued, because I don't believe any responsible person would have extended a mortgage loan to an illegal immigrant until very, very recently. But that's a huge section that's going to start collapsing, and that's something the Bush administration had been actively encouraging as part of its so-called Ownership Society initiative starting in 2004. So you're right, they found very creative ways of wrecking what had been the world's most dynamic and productive economy.
But, of course, the thing is that they do what they were doing. Alan Greenspan is brilliant. Paul Volcker is brilliant. They do exactly what they were doing. At this time in history, they're setting us up to destroy our economy.
Yeah, and it really is quite an interesting exercise in controlled demolition. This isn't something that's just happening. I mean, they're strategically positioned cutting charges that are bringing down our economy. And there are people who have been sapping our economy, of course, for decades, but I think that what's happened is that when they created, just in the last 5 or 6 or 10 years, this huge market for derivatives, and when they started promiscuously getting people involved in the mortgage refinancing merry-go-round, when everybody knew what direction that would go. I remember back in 2003, Greenspan, at a time when he had reduced the prime rate to the point where it was almost completely non-existent. We weren't quite into the territory that Japan went into just before their real estate bubble collapsed in the late 80s or early 90s, where they actually had negative interest mortgage lending going on for a while, where they reduced your principal for taking out a loan. But we were almost to that point. Greenspan went before Congress talking about the fact that they had reduced the prime rate as far as they could go, and that the very next meeting of the Fed governors would result in a rate increase, a small but substantial rate increase. He asked people to go out and refinance to an adjustable rate mortgage again, knowing, of course, that he was going to be raising the interest rates. Now, he was asking people to do this in spite of the fact that if he took out an ARM, an adjustable rate mortgage loan at that time, it would adjust only one direction. But he did that anyway. And people, for whatever reason, were credulous enough to do this, a lot of people anyway. So it's not just a question of the depraved ingenuity of people like Greenspan and Bernanke. Helicopter Ben Bernanke is his sobriquet, because he's talked about throwing bundles of money out of helicopters as a way of staving off deflation. They actually tried that strategy in Iraq, by the way, through Reconstruction. They were actually pitching bundles of dollars out of helicopters and off the back of trucks. But these people are not just depraved in their ingenuity. They have the tremendous advantage of a very credulous public, which for some reason is willing to act as if what these people are telling them makes sense.
I know, and of course the tragedy is people have forgotten the lessons of history, and of course Sidney, Alan Greenspan is not, though. He knows exactly what he's doing, as do the other members of the Fed, because of course they have a different loyalty. They know what's going to happen.
Sure.
And that's why I believe that they're setting up those concentration camps now, because they know there's going to be civilian unrest. here in the area where I live, which is Monterey County, right across the street. We live in Santa Cruz County, across the bay, Monterey County, and then, of course, San Luis Obispo. Housing foreclosures are up 1,000%.
Oh, my word.
Up 10 times what they have been. I mean, and this is a fairly affluent area. This is certainly over the last 6 months or so, up tenfold. So understand that we're in for real trouble, and if it can happen here, it can happen all across America. Certainly the banks are beginning to put aside money for these loans that they know are going to go down, and almost all the banks are holding some of these loans. And what you're going to see, of course, then, is the drying up of credit. What you're going to see is the beginning of erosion and eventually collapse of the whole economic system, which is built upon credit and debt. And, of course, as they begin to contract, then, of course, we see two alternatives, either runaway inflation, throwing the money out of the helicopters, or, of course, the severe consequences of doing the right thing, and, of course, getting literally millions of people out of jobs.
Well, you know, over here in Fayette County, Idaho, which is a small rural county in a very small state, my family moved here in late 2005, and even in late 2005, here in Fayette County, which is by no means an affluent part of the country, there were signs that were posted at regular intervals in the main drive on I-95 coming into the town, advertising the services of liquidation realtors. In other words, we buy houses for cash fast. You can see them now in places like Payette or Caldwell here in Idaho. And Idaho had been undergoing a boom because people were moving here, fleeing from California. You know, fleeing up here from California and just trying to get out of the tumult and chaos of the immigration situation there and the regulations that are choking a lot of businesses, that joined the flight of people who are leaving California for places like Nevada, Arizona, a lot of them coming up here in Idaho because life is relatively inexpensive up here. But even though we had this influx of people bringing money into Idaho, there were still mortgages that were being foreclosed at a shocking rate. This was in 2005, and it's just gotten worse. We had a section of the Boise exurbs called Meridian. It's one of the fastest growing places in the country. A lot of people moving up from California who are involved in various kinds of professional work. Houses were very expensive. Rents were very high. They were building out, and since, I believe, June or July of last year, housing prices leveled off and started to decline, but they're still building because of existing contracts. And just on sheer momentum, they're still building up these houses that are going to lay dormant or never be finished. We have a huge ski resort that was being built in the northern part of the state that got about halfway through construction and suddenly stopped because the financing fell through. And this is something that was being supported by people with international connections. Some international investors were building this. And because the ski resort was going in, housing prices went up, real estate values went up, and, of course, property taxes went up. And so a lot of people were driven off their property, driven out of their homes because they couldn't afford the property taxes. That was going on as well up in the Panhandle, up in places like Coeur d'Alene and Sandpoint. And so you see that sort of thing happening even here in Idaho, where people tend to be a little bit more frugal. People are more modest in their means, a little bit more modest in their objectives. It's like that in the Greenwood. You can only imagine what it's like in the dry.
Well, I think we're in for some very, very bad times. Of course, we've been encouraging our listeners for a long period of time to begin making preparations for just what's happening today. But, you know, do you think they're going to go with hyperinflation, or are they going to contract the money supply and try to save the dollar?
Well, they're not going to try to save the dollar by contracting the money supply, because they can't. The only way that they can maintain their empire is by making sure that the dollar remains plentiful. And so I think what they're going to do is they're going to be casting around for some other asset to liquidate. And so I think it's time to haul the kids down to the blood bank and stick a needle in their arm, so to speak, which is what the draft amounts to. I don't think that they're entirely in control of all the levers of power here. I don't think that they can predict to a relatively comfortable level of certainty how certain things will turn out. Anytime you go to war, for instance, you're rolling the iron dice, as Kaiser Wilhelm put it. And so I think that there were some miscalculations with respect to what was going on in Iraq. And I think largely the objective in Iraq was to consolidate control over the world's energy supply, to have political leverage here in order to bring about the resource base necessary to carry out their objectives.
Well, because my fear is that they would like to go to war with Iran, which mm-hmm. would be totally illogical at this time when we're having to borrow close to $3 billion a day just to pay our debts. If we go to war with Iran, it'll run up the price of oil, which, of course, will contract our economy even further. And yet we may have no choice. Israel may very well attack Syria and Iran to protect themselves, and if they do, we'll be drawn in. We're living at the most exciting times in history. Our guest has been William Greig. Well, William, let's go ahead and get your website out there for our listeners so people know how to get in touch with you.
All right. The best and easiest way to get a hold of the things that I am writing would be to go to The Right Source Online, which is a web portal for my blog, and also it has a regularly updated news feature and access to the Right Source radio program, which is co-hosted by Kevin Shannon and Tom Edlam, and I'm on that program on Fridays. RightSourceOnline.com, one word, RightSourceOnline.com, will take you to that web portal. It'll give you access to my blog, which is entitled Pro Libertate, and the e-journal, which is coming out more irregularly than I'd hoped, which is also called Pro Libertate. We're working on another issue that will be ready in a couple of weeks. And my blog, Pro Libertate, is updated between 3 and 6 times a week, depending upon other contingencies with everything else I've got going on. My forthcoming book has undergone a title change. It is now called Liberty in Eclipse, and it details a lot of the developments we're talking about right now with respect to the militarization of law enforcement and the creation of an executive tyranny at the expense of our Republican system and the order of liberties protected by the Bill of Rights. I'm also working on another book right now, co-writing it, on what's going on with the military, and its tentative working title is Janissaries of the Empire. The Janissaries, of course, were the mercenaries of the Ottoman Turks, and they were the blood tax. They were the young men taken from the Christian tributaries of the Ottoman Empire and used to collect the taxes that were imposed on the Christians by the Turks. And I think that's the situation we're approaching right now, where our young people would be the blood tax that we would pay, and they would be used to collect the physical taxes from us in order to sustain this horrible empire that's metastasizing all around us. And that should be done sometime later on this year, probably late fall.
Well, of course, we'll do everything we can to help you get those books out, and
thank
of course,
you.
To get your information out. We think it's important, and certainly applaud your efforts, and we need to get together with Kevin Shannon.
Yes.
We've been friends for a long period of time, but to see what we can do more effectively to get people to understand what is going on and the consequences of this drive for empire. And as I agree with you totally, we are moving into very uncertain times, and one of two things will happen. Either, of course, the establishment, the cabal that runs things will lose control, or we will go into a totally tyrannical state. And I think that we're going to know within a matter of months rather than years. This is, I believe, the climax of history. We'll be right back in just a moment.
All right.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. We're at the end of our program, but would you one more time tell our listeners how they can get to your blog and your information?
RightSourceOnline.com is the web portal. If you go to the left-hand side of the page, a third of the way down, you'll see a little icon which will have my name and my photograph. And next to it will be a hot link that would take you to my blog, Pro Libertate, and also the Pro Libertate e-zine, or electronic journal that we put out. You go to the blog, it's called Pro Libertate, that's Latin for freedom. That was the motto on the Wallace family crest, as in William Wallace from Braveheart. And that blog is updated probably 3 to 5 or 6 times a week. It is a multimedia blog, which means that there are often video clips and audio clips that are embedded in there. I should point out as well that if you go to my blog, you'll also be provided with a link to my daily radio commentary, which is called Will Griggs Liberty Minute. There's an archive online of the Liberty Minute commentaries. They're only a minute long, hence Liberty Minute, and they're intended to provide a commentary on current events from the perspective of a freedom-obsessed Christian father. I think that's the best way to describe them.
Well, God bless you for everything you do.
Thank you.
Forward, hopefully, to talking to you in the near future.
It'd be wonderful.
Bye-bye. All right, fine. Well, this is, certainly is William Craig. I'm enjoying his commentaries. I hope you are as well. I think we're privileged to be able to have him here and to share the information he has. He's certainly one of the most articulate spokesmen we have, certainly, in the conservative movement. I've always admired his writing from afar, but having met him and having had the opportunity then to talk to him a number of times, I would hope that you would begin to realize how fortunate indeed we are. Understand we're entering very difficult times financially. If you've not yet read my pamphlet, The History of Money or Financial Tsunami, let me suggest you get that, along with Ed Griffin's book, Creature from Jekyll Island, Professor Sutton's book, The Federal Reserve Conspiracy, and Andrew Dixon White's book, written well over 100 years ago, Fiat Money, Inflation in France. You need to know what has happened in the past so you can begin to anticipate what's happening now and begin to protect yourself as best you can in a country that seems intent upon the destruction of freedom. We have a great four-tape set on the Military Commission Act that goes into the Military Commission Act and the John Warner Defense Appropriation Act with the destruction of the Posse Comitatus laws, and, of course, those laws which protected us from the military being used against the American population. Well, there's so much going on today, and we'll be doing all sorts of programs here in the next few weeks covering more and more of this. Of course, we hope many of you have made your preparations. I think we're moving into a crisis situation. If you'd like to get a catalog dealing with emergency food or healthcare products, we have separate catalogs for emergency food, healthcare products, and then a regular catalog of the products we offer. Go to our website at RadioLiberty.com. RadioLiberty.com, where you can read our monthly newsletters. And, of course, if you'd like a free copy of our newsletter, we'd like to consider subscribing to the newsletter or joining the Radio Liberty family. Our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. And then, of course, we do hope that you will encourage others to listen to our programs. They are available. You can hear them live 3 hours a day at RadioLiberty.com. You can hear them live 4 hours a day on Global Star 4. You can hear them 9 hours a day, although there are many repeats there, on our Telstar 5 hookup, or certainly on Global Star 4, our Global Star, and then the fourth channel. Understand we're involved in a spiritual battle for the souls of men and the survival of Western civilization. Please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. Our number again, 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, because we're under attack from within today.
You're tuned to the Global Star Radio Network. Thanks for listening.